This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 223, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 200 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Gary Osborne about the book he co-authored with Jim Penniston, The Rendlesham Enigma. Gary is an author, independent researcher, and expert in ancient symbolism. He is an expert on the correspondence between binary code coordinates associated with Jim Penniston's Rendlesham Forest UFO encounter and notable points on the Giza Plateau. Hi, Gary. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you, Sean.
We're going to talk about the Rendlesham Enigma, your book, and the Giza Prophecy, the Orion Code and the Secret Teachings of the Pyramids. As far as Rendlesham goes, the code came from Jim Penniston, didn't it? Could you tell us what happened with Jim?
Yeah, he encountered this, what he calls an unidentified triangular craft of unknown origin in the Rendlesham Forest, which is adjacent to the twin bases that were loaned to the USAF by the RAF in Suffolk. And Jim lived in Ipswich. Well, it started on Christmas night, and I think around about 11 o'clock in the evening, this light was seen in the forest, and it was unusual, and it was seen by John Burroughs, and Airman John Burroughs, and Bud Steffens, Sergeant Bud Steffens. And they reported this light in the woods that they could see. And Jim Penniston was contacted and told to get to the East Gate at Woodbridge. The East Gate is where they could see into the forest. And this was run about midnight, just a few minutes after midnight when Jim got there. He was briefed on what was being seen and when it actually came down into the forest. And Jim said, how did it land? He said, is it an airplane crash? Because Jim had seen a lot of airplane crashes. He'd been there. He was always sent out to these crashes that happened near the base. So what he saw was this light that was like a dome over this bright light in the woods. This light surrounded by this dome of light. And it didn't diffuse. It was like cut off, you know, as if like a bowl being placed over a candle, you know?
Yeah.
And he said that was really weird when he saw that. Anyway, he said, how did it come down? Is it a crash? And no, Jim, you know, it just came down into the woods. He said, how can that be? How can a plane come down into the woods? Or was it a chopper? He said, no. And John Burroughs blurted out, yeah, we think it's a UFO, you know. So Jim kind of, you know, he thought that was nonsense, and he phoned through to Central Control. And they said that there was a bogey that had been found on radar coming down in that area. So they told Jim to go out there and investigate, and Jim took John Burroughs and Edward Kvansag, who was new to the base, actually. And they went out into the Jeep. They got so far because it was rocky terrain, and they had to leave the Jeep in this area, in this where it wasn't so wooded. Yeah, it was kind of like quite clear of trees. Jim Penniston said to the other two, you stay here, I'll go and investigate. John Burroughs said, no, I'm going to come with you. And then Jim ordered Kvansag to stay back with the Jeep, and he handed him one of the two radios they had. And he said, just take this and we'll relay. Because there was interference on the Motorola radio sets that they were using. So Jim and John Burroughs went into the woods, approaching the light, and there was all this noise and commotion because the animals were running away from whatever this light was. And they were running past Jim and John. And there was birds flying out of the trees. So, and also as they were approaching this light, they felt these electrostatic effects, you know, on their skin. Their hairs were standing up. They could feel it on their clothes. And they also felt like they were wading through water and slowing down as they were, you know, the more they approached this light. Jim said to John, just stay back here. I'm going to go further. Well, John didn't really, you know, he just followed, you know, he didn't stay where he was. He followed Jim. And they got to a berm, you know, this embankment. And Jim, he saw this light that's just so bright. It was like all the cars in a car park where they're, suddenly their headlights come on. It was that bright. And he's ducked down and he's pulled John down with him and they both died to the ground because they thought whatever it was going to explode because it was so bright. This light just started emitting this bright light. And then that died down and then Jim went over the berm towards this, whatever this was, this craft. And he could see it looked like a dirty kind of black something in this bowl of light. John Burroughs stood up behind him and was about to walk further. And then he just stopped, you know, where the edge of this bowl of light was. Jim looked back to him and he said he looked like he was just staring, you know, like a deer in the headlights, you know, this wide stare. And he thought he was a casualty at that point because he didn't move. He was just standing there looking into space. So Jim carried on. And as he walked through that light, which was some kind of shield or something, as he walked through that light, everything, all the fuzziness and the gray and all that, it collapsed and he could see what was at the center clearly. And it was this black craft, black triangular craft that he could not identify. All these years in the USAF, he couldn't identify what this craft was. There was no engines, no intakes, no cockpit. It was like a brick, you know. Although at the back, there was this kind of towel section. So it did kind of resemble a flying craft, but he didn't know how it could fly. And he said it was more like a drone. He said it must have been a drone. It was just too small for anyone to pilot this thing. And, considering the size of the craft, I mean, he paced it. I think it was 9 feet by 9 feet by 9 feet. Nine meters on each side. So it was perfectly triangular. So he said, no, there's no way anyone could be piloting this. Not any of us anyway, unless it's alien and they're really small. But no, he said that his impression was there was no pilots in the thing and it was a drone and being controlled. So he took photographs of it. He took his notebook out and was writing down what he was seeing. You know, that it was 9 meters by 9 meters by 9 meters. And he looked underneath and this was really what puzzled him and kind of frightened him. He saw that the landing pods or legs, they were not structural. They were pure light, as if it was resting on lasers, you know. But the width of the laser must have been about 6 inches, something like that. The diameter. And he could see that they were kind of embedded into the ground. It was kind of like shining into the ground, you know. It's from about a couple of inches. Well, he found that out later when he looks at the landing, the marks left by these landing pods. But that's what frightened him because he said it was as unlike anything that he knew, you know. It's kind of paranormal the way he was looking at this, and it frightened him. And he's had trauma from it. He's had nightmares, and he had to have beta blockers to block out the dreams he was having about it. So, yeah, after that, he's walked around the craft a few times, and he saw these glyphs on the side of the craft. And the skin of the craft was black. It was like black glass. That's how he described it. And there was these glyphs on the side. And there were five smaller glyphs and this large glyph, which was a circle with a triangle inside. And he ran his hands across the smaller glyphs first. And he said it was like sandpaper because they'd been etched into the skin of the craft. And so it was quite rough. And then he touched the large one. And then he had this bright explosion of bright white light in his eyes. And he stepped back and he could see ones and zeros in his mind's eye, you know, like pages and pages of ones and zeros just flashing past his eyes. So, and I say pages, it was just like these images. and then after a few seconds, I don't know how long it was, probably half a minute, his eyesight recovered. It wasn't like he looked at a bright light where you lose your sight for a while. He could see immediately. Once the light had gone, he could see everything around him normally. And he thought that was weird because he thought this bright light was kind of blinding him. And then he drew the glyphs in his notebook. And then he stepped back because he saw that the craft was starting to light up again. And it was getting brighter and brighter. So he went back to where John Burroughs was and pulled John Burroughs down, or they both died to the ground again because they thought this craft, they didn't trust it. It's like it could explode or whatever. And then they saw it lift up. And Jim noted all this in his book, and it just did a kind of 30-degree turn and then shot off really fast in a blink of an eye, and that's what he wrote in his notebook. And then John Burroughs had woken up somehow, and then he'd come up behind Jim, and then John pointed to the light, and he said, "There it is," and they both ran towards it. Well, they didn't catch up with it, and after a while, Jim said that what John Burroughs was pointing to was the lighthouse, you know, which was on the beach, you know, a few miles away. And so anyway, that was the first night. That was the first night's events. But this went over 3 nights, the event. Anyway, Jim, afterwards, I mean, where they had to go back to base and they had to write a report. And Jim used his notebook to write the report, what he enjoyed in his notebook. And that was that. Yeah, they were seen by other officers and that. And then they were told not to talk about it. That night, Jim couldn't get to sleep. These ones and zeros was in his mind all the time. He just couldn't get to sleep. He kept seeing them. And it was making him feel sick. So he got up, made himself a cup of coffee. This was on the morning of the 27th of December, around about 2 o'clock. And he thought, what if I wrote these down? Because I can see him in my mind's eye. What if I wrote them down? Maybe that would get rid of this, you know, sickness I'm feeling over it. So that's what he did. He started to write them down, and then it just flowed. All these ones and zeros just flowed, and he ended up writing down 16 pages. With these ones and zeros. And then after a while of looking at them, he felt better, but after a while looking at them, he thought, this is crazy. I'll be certified as mad, you know, writing these ones and zeros down, because he didn't know what they were. He didn't know it was binary code at the time. Yeah, so what he did was he thought, well, I'll lose my job, and I'll have my gun taken away from me, and I'll no longer be employed. Because he was in security at the base, you know. And John Burroughs was in law enforcement. So there's two different groups there. So yeah, after that, he took the notebook, put it in a drawer, and tried to forget about it. And in future like interviews and that, where he showed the notebook, he would take the pages out because it was a ring binder notebook. He would take those ones and zeros, the pages of those ones and zeros, out and put them at the back of the book. Or he put them in the drawer and just take the book without those pages sometimes, because he didn't want anyone to know about it. Because he thought it was just insane writing these ones and zeros down. He didn't know what was wrong with him. He thought it was some kind of trauma from the event. He didn't know. So, yeah, he tried to forget about him. And he sat on that, on the existence of the binary code for 30 years until 2010. When Prometheus Entertainment, who make the Ancient Aliens series, they had Jim and John on there filming an episode about the incident. And John Burroughs asked Jim about the notebook and said, is there a date in there, a certain date? So Jim started flicking through the notebook, and because he'd left the pages of ones and zeros there. So when he got to the back of the book, or he was flicking through it, John saw the ones and zeros and said, what's that? Jim thought, oh no, I've got to talk about him. Yeah, I've seen him. You know, it's like, John Burroughs has always said that Jim went there loaded with the pages to somehow just get it out there, you know, as if he deliberately went through the pages to show John that. But Jim said no. You see, he definitely didn't want anyone to know about it. Anyway, Linda Moulton Howe was there, and she was standing with John behind Jim as he was flicking through the ones and the pages of the notebook. And she said, that's binary code, Jim. And he said, really? Is that what it is? Yeah. Now, Linda Moulton Howe has interviewed Jim years before, and he told her about this. No, what it was, he didn't tell her about the code, but he went under a hypnosis and she'd got hold of the transcripts of the hypnosis session, and she found that what was being said was these ones and zeros. And so she wrote a book back in 1998, I think it was, where she talks about Jim's experience in the incident, and also she mentioned the code. Jim never read the book, so he didn't know that she knew it was binary code. Okay, well, this all came out on the set of the Prometheus Entertainment shoot of the Ancient Aliens episode, which was in 2010. I think it was October 2010. They did this filming session. And then the episode was aired on the 30th of December, 2010. And because they got excited about the code and the pages of the notebook that had all these ones and zeros, Jim gave them the first five pages to decipher. And Prometheus Entertainment got this guy named Sisk. His surname's Sisk, who he looks at deciphering those five pages, and it had a message. Exploration of humanity. It had the number 666 and 8100 in the first line. And then it had the these coordinates for High Brazil. Well, that's not how you pronounce it. You pronounce it High Brazil. That's how the Irish pronounce it, which is a mythical submerged island off the southwest coast of Ireland. and that was what was televised, the first five pages of the message. But there was a lot more to it than that. There was another six sets of coordinates as well, other than these High Brazil coordinates. Anyway, I first read about that incident when the News of the World newspaper came out about it, you know, on the front page. You know, UFO lands in Suffolk, and that's official, you know. And I thought that's something, that's an incident or event I should be looking at, you know, and I did. I kind of followed it as the years went on. But I didn't know anything about the code, and it was a bit of a surprise when Jim Peniston contacted me, because by that time I was an author, and I was known for working on ancient symbolism and codes and that kind of thing. So Jim was, I was recommended to Jim anyway, my work. And so he contacted me out of blue. And it was quite a shock, really, because I remember seeing a documentary about the Rendlesham incident, and Jim was being portrayed by an actor. And now he's contacting me. Because I thought that's going to be an interesting guy to talk to. But anyway, he contacted me and he said that he had this code that he wanted me to look at. He says there'll be seven sets of coordinates. He's having them deciphered by this guy named Joe Luciano, who's a binary expert, who's also in the USAF. And he said he'd be sending me these. He said the first set of coordinates had already been, it's already been put in the public domain, you know, through Ancient Aliens. He said, there's another six sets of coordinates that I want you to look at. See if you can find any additional information. Just give it your best shot, see what you can, what you come up with. He said he doesn't know why these coordinates are there. Maybe they hold additional information. So he sent me that. He sent me those six sets of coordinates and told me about the seventh, High Brazel, and he sent me those on February the 2nd, 2011. And that's when I started studying the code, started studying the coordinates, especially. And I've been working on the code now for nearly 15 years. It will be, this coming December, it will be 15 years. Actually February, isn't it? That's when I started. So it'll be February.
Could I just ask a couple of quick questions about when he was with the craft? You say that he took photos, but what happened to them?
Yeah, they didn't come out. They were fogged. They were whited out. And I think Monroe Nevels, who was like the photographer on the base, he had his own dark room where he could, work on all these photos. He was the photographer anyway, the main photographer on the base. And he told Jim, no, it must be due to radiation because, you know, that's what happens. So Jim had to just say, yeah, okay. And that was that. That nothing more was said about those photos. Because Jim had him, he had him worked at the base. He took him to the base photography place and they said, no, they've come out all white. You know, so Jim had to just accept that, and that was that. I think he took something like 80 photographs. He was snapping away like crazy around that craft.
How long was the craft there? I've always thought it was, what, a minute or two?
Maybe 45 minutes. Because they said that their watches showed a missing time of 45 minutes. It was a loss of time. There, but they felt that as they were approaching the craft, they felt these kind of electromagnetic effects, and everything felt like it was slowing down.
Did the radiation affect him? Has it caused any illness?
No, not really. Was it Meniere's disease, which is to do with his ear? He's had that. Both of them have had heart problems, both John and Jim. Other than that, nightmares. And Jim went to therapist about it, and she put him on these beta blockers. And later on, she said, "Yo, you need to be hip. You know, you need to have hypnosis sessions." So he had two hypnosis sessions, but these weren't conducted by the UFO community or anything like that. This was what this therapist had advised him to do, because there seemed to be memories that was causing these dreams, these nightmares he was having. So she wanted to get to the bottom of that, really. And then they found that his memory, they went through, in this hypnosis session, they went through the incident and found that the point where he had the binary code download, it was blocked from his memory. Every time he tried to think about that part of the incident, he'd hear a male voice reciting a nursery rhyme This is Mary had a little lad. So, and he was messed with. Jim was messed with by the OSI agents. He was interrogated, and they gave him a truth serum. They injected him sodium pentothal, and they hypnotized him. And they must have put a block on that part of his memory. But they removed. But the therapist, the hypnotherapist, removed that block, and then he could remember about the code. But you see, they didn't think about Jim having written down those ones zeros in his notebook. They didn't ask Jim about the notebook. They didn't know about it. So yeah, it passed under their radar. Really, the proof of what the download is in the notebook. You know, those ones and zeros.
It's weird that the download happened. It's almost as if the craft was there specifically to do that.
Yeah, it seems that way. Even though Jim also had the impression that it was there because it was I don't know, it powered down for some reason, and it was doing something to repair itself. He thought the craft was there, that was repairing itself in some way. So he doesn't know. But now having deciphered the code, I would say, yeah, it was the intention of whatever this intelligence was to pass on this information. Because what's found in the code is that it's pointing to Giza, where the pyramids are, and it's give us information about Giza that we should know by now. So it's like this intelligence is giving us a kick up the backside to know the things about Giza that we should know by now, because it's important, what's been encoded at Giza.
The last thing I wanted to ask about Rendlesham is, what happened to John Burroughs? Does he say that he felt paralysed or that he had missing time?
All he says is he just doesn't remember the craft that Jim encountered. And he's always thought that Jim had made it all up. He just never saw that. He says all he saw was lights. That was it. Yeah.
Okay.
It was as if he was in some kind of suspended animation there on the edge of this light that was surrounding the craft. And it's like it didn't let him in, it let Jim in to perhaps receive this download, binary code, and where John was kept outside, you know. So, yeah, there's been a bit of debate amongst them, and also people who support them. You know, it's caused a rift, really. What John Burroughs is saying is accusing Jim of lying, really. But
when did you first take a look at the code? What did you think of it?
Well, in the first few months, I found all these references to the angle of 23.5 degrees, which is the Earth's obliquity angle, you know, tilt angle. It's tilted in respect to the ecliptic plane by about 23.5. Although the real figure is 23.43 degrees, yeah, and it's decreasing. And I found that when I received all these coordinates, I plotted them all out in Google Earth on the globe, you know. And it was dramatic seeing the cursor move to all these ancient sites where there's pyramids or an ancient, like, sacred mountain, which is Taishan in China. Sedona, there's no pyramid in Sedona, but that's a UFO hotspot. Higher Brazil, Giza, Nazca, the Nazca lines, you know, Naxos, the island of Naxos, ancient Greek island of Naxos, which is where there's a portara there of the Temple of Apollo. It's pointed to that place as well. I mean, it's all these places that it's pointed to. So I watched the cursor move to all these places, and I thought, crikey, it's just strange because they're all ancient sites. So, High Brazil is still submerged, although it seems to be something there from satellite imagery. There's something just under the surface in that location. So, then I wanted to see them all on a map projection of the Earth, you know, a Mercator flat map projection, so I could see them all together. And I started connecting the locations of these coordinates and found that they were connected by significant angles. 23.5 degrees again, 11.75, which is half of 23.5, and also 51 degrees, which you would recognize to be the side sloping side angles of the Great Pyramid, yeah, which is 51. They're 51.84 degrees, but 51 is close enough for you to identify that as being the side angle of the Great Pyramid. And together, all these seven sets of coordinates draw up an image of the Great Pyramid in cross-section, you know, just a triangle, centralized to the Greenwich Meridian in the equator. And it's pointing to the chambers we know of inside the Great Pyramid, and also a third chamber we don't know about. So when I first started finding the 23.5 degree angle, I thought Jim was yanking my chain here. I thought he may have hoaxed this, you know, because that's my work. That was work that I was doing research into all these angles of the 20 to, in these paintings from the 17th century mostly, or other sources where you find the angle of 23.5 degrees encoded. Yeah, there's the Earth's axis obliquity angle. So for why there's all these references throughout history to the Earth's tilt angle? So when I saw that, I thought, well, this is like the signature of my research work, you know, it's personal to me. Because that's what I've been working on since 2000. It's just one of the things that I've been working on. But to see it come up in the code and these angles between the coordinates that were found, which was received by Jim Peniston, I thought, you know, maybe he has a hand in doing this all himself, you know. But then I realized after working on the code for so long and all these other things started emerging, I thought there's no way Jim Peniston could have done this. He wouldn't even have the patience. I mean, Jim doesn't really read anything about what I've kind of lived and breathed the last 30 years. He wouldn't know anything about Giza, really. He'd have to have known all what I know to have put all this into the code. And he just don't have the patience for that. He's a no-nonsense, down-to-earth guy, a military guy. So all that was left for me to find out. But the reason why he got in touch with me in the first place was because there was this mutual friend, a ufologist, a female who was living in South Africa at the time, and she was a member of UFO Corps, which is a South African UFO group. And she was with Jim at the time for what, because she was asking for information and that sort of thing, and they got into a relationship which didn't last long because she was after information. And she said to Jim, because he said he had dreams of someone telling him 23.5 degrees, verbally saying 23.5 degrees, and he thought it had something to do with temperatures on the planet, certain regions. But anyway, he told her, and then she said, you need to get in contact with Gary Osborne because his work is related to the Earth's axis thing, 23.5 degrees. Well, no, she didn't actually say axis at the time. She said 23.5 degrees. And then he contacted me, and his title of his email was 23.5 degrees. So I asked him about that. And he, as I said, he thought they were temperatures on the planet, and I had to put him right about it, saying that's the Earth's axis obliquity angle. He said, oh, right, I should have learned about that at school, but I can't record it because, you know, you're told all these facts, and if they don't mean anything to you personally, you just forget them. So, yeah, he realized that's what it was pointing to. But as I said, the coordinates all draw up this image of the Great Pyramid to the Greenwich Meridian and equator. So that was the initial information I found in the first few months of working on it.
Well, can I ask you about other things that are in the code? Because I've got it here in front of me. So at the top, it says exploration for humanity. 666-8100. And I suppose you can only guess, but what do you think that means?
Well, I know now what it means. I've worked on the code. As I said, I've been working on the code all these years, and I realized that, no, Jim had nothing to do with this, because it actually predicted a 12-digit number that come up in 2018, 38 years after the incident. And I'll get onto that later. But yeah, when you say, what does that mean, those numbers, they mean something associated with Giza, with a timeline that's been encoded at Giza, called the Giza Diagonal. If you look at the pyramids from an aerial elevation, yeah, satellite image of the pyramids, you'll see that the way they're configured, they're in a diagonal placing, yeah, and their southeast corners, if you was to put a line through their southeast corners, that would be what I'm talking about, the Giza Diagonal. It's an abstract line, but it's a timeline. It's a processional timeline. And it has the year 8100 on that timeline, because you can actually determine specific dates, years on that timeline. And this is all in the new book that I've got coming out this year, all that information about Giza that's come from the code. So this timeline, processional timeline, the processional cycle is nearly 26,000 years. I think scientific estimates is 25772 years it takes for this cycle to complete itself. The ancients used the number 25920 because you can reduce those numbers down to 9, and all the subdivisions of that number all amount to 9. So it was easier to remember and easier to encode. But that's what's been encoded at Giza, is this timeline from 10460 BC to 2500 AD. And then you can determine all the dates between those two extreme dates on the timeline. And this has all been pointed out by the code, actually, you know. And I'd already worked on the Giza Diagonal with Scott Crichton, and we wrote a book called The Giza Prophecy in 2012. And the manuscript for that book was sent to the publishers. I mean, the last draft of that book was sent to the publishers the very same week when Jim Pennison sent me the 6 Riemannian coordinates to look at. And then I find that the Giza Diagonal is being pointed to by the coordinates in the code, which had already featured in the book I wrote with Scott Crichton.
So with the timeline, is there things marked out on it that you can spot and say?
No, it's not a physical thing. It's an abstract line, which is just defined by the southeast corners of the pyramids, the three large pyramids. And of course, you know that the pyramids are supposed to be reflections of the three belt stars of Orion. Well, that was Robert Bovell who found that. And it was him. Well, you know, I'd written papers with Robert Bovell. So, yeah, we were friends. We still are. Just that Robert Bovell is no longer, you know, doing anything because of an illness he had. But, yeah, we used to talk a lot. Me and Robert discussed Giza and all that. And he didn't know about the Giza Diagonal. In fact, well, he did know about the Giza Diagonal, but he didn't know how that worked with his Orion correlation theory. So what I'm saying is that the code is what you find with these coordinates in the code, they're pointing to this Giza Diagonal line, which is related to the Orion correlation theory of Robert Bovell. But he discovered Giza pyramids reflect the three belt stars in 1983, and the code comes from 1980. So there you see a time anomaly there.
Does that diagonal, you said something about being starting at 10,000, was it 860?
Yeah, 10460 BC, and then it ends 2500 AD in our future. I think it's 474 years in the future, yeah.
So do you think that indicates 10,000 years ago or 12,000 years ago is the date the pyramids were built, or perhaps the date that they were laid out?
I think the plan, I think the design of Giza was probably from that time, yeah. Yeah. The way everything's been laid out. I mean, I've covered everything now in this new book. So when people read that, they'll be able to see. Everything's laid out clearly for everyone to follow. They can repeat my step-by-step process and how I found these all this information by using the code. And they can repeat it and find out for themselves. There's nothing better than finding out for yourself, you know? But the way I've laid it all out in this new book, they'll be able to, you know, follow what I've done and find it themselves. Yeah. This is a very difficult subject to talk about, you know? There's so much to remember. Because it's like almost 15 years worth of study that to discuss, and I can't discuss everything, you know? It's just too much information. But yeah, the code, what has emerged from the code could fill three large volumes. It's weird. And of course, only one set of coordinates is what I've been focusing on for this new book, which is the Giza coordinates. Because I already knew about Giza. I'd already researched Giza a good 20 years before the code fell into my lap. So I already, you know, understood a lot about Giza. And you have to think, why did the code come to me to decipher, you know? Well, it must be because of my knowledge of Giza, because all the information about Giza is coming out now. And this is a new understanding that's going to be put out in this book this year. And it's going to astound a lot of people because it's overturned everything we thought we knew about Giza. And it's all because of this advanced intelligence that has given us a nudge to discover these things that we should know by now. So that's a phenomenon. It's just so phenomenal, all this, you know.
So what is the message in the code, or isn't there really a message? Is it trying to tell us something?
Well, I'll give you a list of the things it's pointing to. It's pointing to this Giza diagonal as a timeline, processional timeline. And in that timeline, it seems to be cataclysm dates, yeah? In that timeline that come around every now and again. And that's what he's pointing to. It's like a warning system. The whole Giza plateau, the complex, everything is like it's like a warning system for the planet, you know, that we go through these periods where there's catastrophes. So that's one thing. And then it's also pointing to the Azores in the Atlantic. And there's a line from the Sphinx all the pass through and between the two largest pyramids, all the way to the west, where São Miguel Island is in the Atlantic, one of the eight islands of the Azores. And, you know, there's always been this narrative that ancient Egypt was the legacy of a lost civilization, which they think is Atlantis. And, of course, the Azores have always been imagined to be where Atlantis was, that they're the peaks of the mountains of the submerged Atlantis. Those seven, nine islands. Well, there's nine islands, but there's seven that are grouped together. So what the Giza coordinates has done is point into the Sphinx, and this line that points to the Sphinx is in three processional number distance. What I mean is the distance is in meters, but when you convert that meter distance into the three British imperial measures of feet, inches, and yards, you got three processional numbers, three subdivision processional numbers. And it's pointing to the Sphinx. And if you take that line in the opposite direction, it goes all the way to the center of São Miguel Island, which is only 290 square miles in an ocean that's 41.1 million square miles. It's astounding.
What about this unknown chamber in the pyramid? How does that come out?
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things it's pointing to. It's also not, when I say that the Giza coordinates are pointing to the Sphinx, it's pointing to a special location on the Sphinx, or beneath the Sphinx's left forepaw. And there's you know, people believe that there's hidden chambers beneath the left forepaw of the Sphinx, or underneath the Sphinx. So, and then I found that Dr. Robert Schock and Dr. Thomas DeBecky had used seismic refraction tomography to find hidden voids, subsurface voids beneath the Sphinx. And one of the voids they found is what the Giza coordinates from the code is pointing to. So it's pointing to something hidden under the Sphinx. And if you take that line in the opposite direction, it goes all the way to San Miguel Island and then the Azores, as if saying that whatever was deposited under the Sphinx, cache of records, for instance, comes from the what may have been the ancient homeland of the ancient Egyptians, which is in the Azores, which is where Atlantis may have been. I'm just thinking about the other things the code is pointing to at Giza.
I was just wondering, do you think the Sphinx was originally a lion and that the ancient Egyptians remodeled it?
Yes, a lioness. Yeah. Yeah, because strange thing, I met up with Manu Seifzadeh. In fact, he came to visit me and my wife. He lives in California, and Dr. Seifzadeh is an author. He's passionate about Giza. He's been out to Giza many times. He's written a book called Under the Sphinx, where he talks about a cache of records that may be deposited there before the pre-dynastic period, the first pre-dynastic period of Egypt. And he's saying that the cache of records that were deposited there may have been breached just before the first dynastic period, during the pre-dynastic period. And says it may have been breached, and the information that was deposited there may have kick-started the ancient Egyptian civilization, because the information is probably astronomical, probably about precession and other things, you know, this sacred knowledge that may have been breached, and that's what kick-started the ancient Egyptian civilization. But where that knowledge comes from is another thing. It may have come from what the coordinates are pointing to is the Azores. There's all these data points.
So if this code came from a UFO in Rendlesham Forest and it's all about Giza, does that sort of indicate that whoever's the pilots of that craft have been to Giza, may have had something to do with construction of it, or anything to do with it?
Yeah, this intelligence seems to have so much knowledge about Giza that you wonder if the Giza plateau is somehow retrocausal. What I mean is, it may have come from the future or from a domain outside our timeline. The information may have been picked up by the shamans of the ancient Egyptians to build these pyramids. They may have been they may have picked up that knowledge somehow by some sort of communion with other intelligences. In fact, Robert Bovell, you know, he was entertaining that idea that somehow they must have got this knowledge, maybe from shamanic experiences, you know. Words are just going out of my mind. Wait a minute. They're trance states. They may have been able to pick up information from trance states, and they were able to, and it inspired them to build this complex, maybe. But whatever the situation is, it seems that this intelligence that devised the code may have something to do with Giza as well. Yeah, with the plan and design of Giza.
So what about the other parts of the code? One of them at the end says origin year 8100. What do you make of that?
Well, that's the year I was saying it was on the Giza diagonal timeline. That's one of the years. And it's being pointed to by a distance of 666 meters. So there you've got the 666 and the 8100. And the distance is from the Sphinx, between the Sphinx and the second pyramid, the center of the second pyramid. And that distance, as I said, is exactly 666 meters. And it passes, it intersects the Giza diagonal and passes through it to reach the G2 center. And it passes through the Giza diagonal at that year, which is 8100, which you're able to determine on the timeline.
Right, okay.
I don't know how, I don't know if who's listening to this could bring all this together with what I'm saying. See, I have to go from one thing to another, but really it's all in the book. Everything is laid out, you know, one thing to another, so people can see it, understand it all.
Why do you think that High Brazil is listed twice in the message?
Yeah, you see, it generates more questions, doesn't it, than answers. High Brazil may be some kind of, it may have something to do with the Azores, the Atlantis, that, you know, the landmass there may have become submerged. High Brazil may have been part of that landmass. I don't know. Yeah, look, the other thing I wanted to say is I've concentrated mostly on the Giza coordinates found in the code, but there's the other coordinates, the other sets of coordinates that need studying, and other people are going to have to look into this, you know? They're going to have to take up the baton and from me and work on these other sets of coordinates. It's all there for people to decipher. They want to have a go at it. I've concentrated mostly on the Giza coordinates in the code. Also Nazca, the Nazca coordinates. I found some things there that I haven't, I've not put in this next book, but I will in a following book, hopefully. So yeah, it's all out there potentially for other people to study and find things for themselves.
Is the next book called The Giza Prophecy?
No, the next book is called The Timeless Conception. And the reason why I call it that is because Giza, to me personally, is timeless. They can't really put a date to it. Even though Egyptologists and mainstream scholars, orthodox, they will say that the pyramids were built around about 2500 BC. You know, what we're finding all the time is pushing the date back, and we can't really put a date to it. So I call it the timeless conception, because it is a conception as well as conceived. And it seems to be related to some divine intelligence. You know, this conception at Giza, and I call it a timeless conception. So that's what I'm calling the book.
And when will that be out?
This year. I wanted to try and get it out for April, which is around my birthday. But because of the formatting problems we're having with, and it has over 450 diagrams and illustrations in it, it may be pushed back a bit further. So we might have to wait as long as it's out before August.
So the other books you've done, the Rendlesham Enigma and the Giza Prophecy, and people can get those on Amazon now, can't they?
Yeah, sure. In fact, the last book I did with Jim Penniston, the Rendlesham Enigma book one, Timeline, is published on Amazon. We published it through Amazon. And that's what I'm doing with the new book as well. So also I've had other books out, you know, The Shining Ones, which was 2006, and before that, The Serpent Grail, 2005. So this, and I've always written books with other people because they asked me, you know. And this book that I've got coming out now this year will be my own book. It's the first book I've ever had published by myself. Yeah.
And do you have a website?
No, I did, but because I think it was 2006 when I started the website. And it was Moonfruit, and of course the Flash, Adobe Flash. No, it was Adobe Flash website, and that went down. Adobe Flash is no longer, you know, in existence. So the website was having problems, so I stopped it. And I've got to try and create a new website, but because I've been working on this code, I just haven't got around to it. You know, but it's not really about me. You know, one thing I want to tell you, I don't care, you know, about me being. Having fame from this or money or anything like that. I don't care about all that, you know. It's not about me, it's about a code. And I like the book to speak for itself, you know.
Well, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Simon. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
And that was an interview with Gary Osborne about the book he co-authored with Jim Penniston, The Rendlesham Enigma. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. And if you want to try the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And if you enjoy this episode, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.